Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSEO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future. Why do we
never get... Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're at a point in time where the evolution of robotics and artificial intelligence is extremely fertile, creating new advances poised to radically transform our lives as we know them. And new inventions like self-driving cars, elder care robots, personal flying machines, cybernetic soldiers, and surgical assistants. So the question is, will these advances help create a more exalted humanity or delegate our species to the dustbin of history? So to help answer this question, we have John Markoff on, science correspondent for the New York Times and author of a new book called Machines of Loving Grace, all about the evolution of AI and robotics. So, John, are you on the phone? You there?
I am. Hi.
Great. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Now, Machines of Loving Grace, can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, you know, I'm part of a generation who grew up during the 1960s, and I read a lot of Richard Brautigan poetry once long ago. And in the 1980s, I stumbled across a poem of his, which is titled All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. And I've always really liked it. But it's met with a little bit of irony, you know. I might have put a question mark at the end of the...
It could go either way, I guess, is what you're saying. Now, you've been investigating this area now for years. I mean, you've been in this industry for as long as I have, not longer. So where does it go back? With artificial intelligence, we hear about it all the time in science fiction, Forbin Project, 2001, of course, things like that. But what's the real origins of it in your research? What have you found?
When I was working on an earlier book about a decade ago, I noticed that there were two laboratories in the early 1960s on either side of Stanford campus. One was John McCarthy's Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, and the other was Doug Engelbart's Augmentation Research Center. And they both were created in 1962. Mm-hmm. McCarthy set out to build a machine that basically mimicked everything that humans do, you know, from robotics to AI, replaced the humans. He thought it would take a decade in 1962 to do that.
To actually replace humans in a decade. Wow.
Yeah, he thought a working AI was a decade-long project at that point. The field of AI has long been over-optimistic. And on the other side of campus, Doug Engelbart, who, you know, you probably know as the inventor of the mouse and hypertext.
The mouse is the main thing I think he's known for. Hypertext, is that what you said also?
Yeah, he also invented hypertext. And much of the stuff that we use today in terms of personal computing and the modern internet really traces its way back to Doug. But Doug really was trying to sort of build tools that could augment human intelligence for small groups of workers to allow them to work together more effectively on intellectual challenges. And so I realized that those were two really sort of philosophically opposed ideas right at the dawn of computing. And what came out of those two ideas were two different communities. One was the AI community, and the other was what's now called the humans and computer interaction community. And they've basically not spoken to each other much in the intervening five decades, almost six decades.
So the augmentation world more sees the computing as something to enhance our human cognition and human capability, while the other group doesn't really care that much about human capability.
I think that's a good way of stating it. You know, I guess, you know, Steve Jobs had the best framing of this. Like, it just got picked up in the Steve Jobs biopic. Mm. He talked about personal computers as a bicycle for the mind. Mm. And I always liked that phrase. But that's sort of what Doug was trying to do, too.
Hmm. And he's been somewhat successful in that evolution. I guess the whole GUI evolution can be seen as a way of making the computers more friendly to human cognition.
Yeah, I think that's very true. They've had a big impact on the world. And, you know, the AI community for a long time failed. I mean, they had great promise, and there were these really giant failures, commercial failures. Even in the 1980s, I think you probably remember the AI winter when all these companies failed. Hmm. You know, they didn't make a lot of progress until really fairly recently, 2010.
I want to ask you, why do you think they failed? What do you think was going on?
Well, they failed because they simply put, they couldn't deliver the goods. They made these promises about the capabilities of expert systems, and the expert systems were largely brittle and didn't perform well and actually didn't sort of deliver commercial value. And that was sort of the simple reason why they failed. Hmm. Now we're in this new era of machine learning and technologies like deep learning, Bayesian systems that are having, you know, a real impact in areas like speech and vision, perception, where they are making progress and are doing things that are of commercial utility.
Hmm. Now, they both have succeeded to exist to this day, too, the augmenting of human intelligence and the replacing of human intelligence. They both seem to be living communities even to this point. And would you say that one is winning more than the other in you know, what will adapt for our species? Or do you think they'll both continue to play a role?
Well, you know, it's actually the big question. I think it's a very important question. I think sort of understanding what's going to happen more than a half decade into the future is a really difficult thing. As a reporter, I still don't have to do that for a living. My point has been that, as these systems become more powerful, it remains, for the foreseeable future, it's a human choice. It's something that the designers, will control. They can decide what the relationship is between the machines that we're building, the systems that we're building, and the human groups, societies, individuals. I mean, we can design these things as masters or slaves or hopefully partners.
Right, some kind of new paradigm perhaps that's even better than the old ones.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Listen, we got to go for a commercial break, John, but we'll be right back. About two minutes in the future?
Great.
Yeah, okay, we'll see you in a moment. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking about augmented intelligence, and we're talking about artificial intelligence. We're talking to John Markoff. Some questions are coming in, John. How does this connect to autonomous vehicles? Well, there's an AI component to the cars, and there's a Stanford link.
That's right. Very early work on self-driving vehicles, I wouldn't call them cars, was done at Stanford. And around the same time, there was early work being done at Stanford Research Institute, which became SRI International. It didn't go anywhere really significantly until 2004 when DARPA, the Pentagon's sort of blue sky research agency, started these contests. They had three contests between 2004 and 2007 because Congress had sort of mandated the U.S. military, the Pentagon, that a third of the ground-based land vehicles be self-driving by 2015. Here we are in 2015. Well, they didn't make it.
How close are they, do you think?
Not very. In terms of putting actually wheels on the ground, they've done some experiments. They've got some prototypes. But in terms of building this technology into Humvees or tanks or into other logistic vehicles, it's going to take a while. I mean, I think it's possible, actually, and it will happen, but it's not happened on the ground. Where it did happen was in the air, more than half of U.S. military aircraft are drones.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. Yeah, the drones are very powerful technology, and yet that is a technology. They're fast, cheap, and out of control. I just bought one for $1,000. Right?
Yeah,
GoPro
sure.
camera.
Sure. So. It raises all kinds of questions about autonomous weapons that I don't think we've answered yet, and the possibility of an arms race that might not end well.
Exactly. Yeah. And so what do we do with this? How do we steer that?
Well, there is an active campaign, an international one, to try to limit by treaty the development of these systems. Some people sort of are pessimistic about that, but, we've done a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've done a pretty good job of limiting nuclear weapons. We've limited them a little bit, and we've had better luck limiting biological and chemical weapons. And, many, many nations, the United States not included, are signatories to an international treaty banning landmines, which, of course, are the simplest autonomous weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's impossible, and I think it's politically important to sort of pursue that.
Do you think maybe they're useful far outweigh their potential danger, like they might become another planetary transport system, drone transport?
So that's interesting. I've been at NASA Ames in Mountain View, where they're in the midst of designing the air traffic control system for a world in which, the way they describe it, the sky is dark with drones.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that really, I think there'll be a lot of resistance to that. I think technically it's possible. But whether we actually want our, you know, suburban neighborhoods to be full of little machines flying back and forth?
Yeah, no, there is a limit for sure. I think the rules definitely have to evolve for that. But it seems to me, I was at a drone convention recently where the main thing was to be able to deliver medicines over a terrain that didn't have very good roads. There seems to be a natural for drone transport, and a big part of the planet has that system. Yes, Mrs. Future.
Well, I'm just thinking in regards to this, if we imagine what we would like the planet like, instead of a system where the sky is dark with drones, it seems to me the best of the possibilities of these autonomous vehicles is maybe that we wouldn't have to drive everywhere, but we could send stuff on automatic vehicles to where it needed to go. So it's almost like the whole planet could be a, you know, like a kid's train set or something like that.
I read a piece that appeared yesterday on the Times website about a company called Starship Technologies that has been started by two of the Skype co-founders, which is intended to do exactly that. They're extremely cute little devices with six wheels. They're like a large cooler on wheels with cameras and radars. And the idea is that your local grocery store or drugstore in a suburban area will have this vehicle that has a top speed of 4 miles an hour that they can send out to your house with the groceries, and except for the danger of teenagers who will harass these things, I think that's a great idea. It runs on the power of a 50-watt light bulb.
Oh, man.
And it can have a 2-mile range, and in some certain suburban areas, I think it makes a lot of sense to do things like that, where you would push a button on your smartphone and the groceries would show up, and you'd walk out and unlock the top of this vehicle and get them. And I think that's now, they claim that they can do that for less than a dollar a trip.
It reminds me of Steve, the guy who used to drive the behemoth.
Behemoth? Yeah, the bike.
Steve Roberts.
Steve Roberts, right.
Steve Roberts. Oh, yeah. He protected his behemoth basically by having a little AI that would take a picture of anybody who was molesting it and would send him a message, you know?
A basic sensor, yeah. No intelligence necessary.
Right. So it seems to me that that would be how we'd have to handle the propensity of teenagers to bother these automatic vehicles. Right.
Yeah,
it's accountability.
Well, there'll be an immune system. They'll all have their own immune systems.
Yes.
So one of the things that's come up is the idea of sci-fi. Sci-fi seems to play a role in a lot of the seminal belief systems of the engineers who have created these technologies. And I'm wondering if there are any specific sci-fi stories that you heard in your research that tie to what's unfolding now in these arenas.
The most frequent, at least cited science fiction movie was Space Odyssey 2001. And I ran into more than a handful of then young future engineers who were inspired to go out and build HAL, which was not my reaction, but obviously it had a tremendous force on the culture and it had a tremendous impact on a generation of young future AI scientists.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a classic.
It was a classic. The other thing that I found interesting, sort of a bit of historical research that came out, do you remember the Knowledge Navigator video?
Oh, yeah,
classic.
The Apple one. Yeah,
sure.
That was actually envisioned, right? They actually created a device of the future and put it in an Apple commercial in 1987.
That's right. It was John Sculley. Steve Jobs had left, and Sculley needed a vision. And what I found that was really striking is that the two architects of Siri, Adam Chire and Tom Gruber, were both inspired to build Knowledge Navigator, and that's where Siri came from.
Hmm.
It was the direct inspiration.
Wow.
And so, you know, I traced it back. I knew that Alan Kay had been the one who had come up with the conception of Knowledge Navigator for John Sculley, and so I went to Alan and I said, you know, where did you get the idea? Where did the ideas come from? And he said, oh, I was simply channeling Nicholas Negroponte, who, of course, had been the director of the Media Lab. And if you were around the Media Lab during the 1980s and early 1980s in particular, they did a lot of stuff around conversational agents. That was a very sort of important design principle that they really sort of pioneered. So I went to Nicholas and I said, Nicholas, where did you get these ideas? And he said, oh, that's simple. I got them from Gordon Pask. And I said, who? Because I'd never heard of Gordon Pask. And then I did some research and looked into this guy, and he was this really fascinating British cyberneticist and multimedia artist who was sort of active in the 1970s and 1980s. He used to come to America. He would stay with Marvin Minsky.
Yeah.
And he had a big influence in this sort of little area early in the 1980s. And what was significant about Pasch is he, in turn, was a cyberneticist. So you can trace Pasch all the way back to Norbert Wiener and this idea of cybernetic systems. Mm-hmm. Pasch had this fascinating theory of intelligence where he argued that intelligence was rooted in the conversation between two human actors.
Oh, yeah. Like it's not the either person, but the interaction of their conversation.
That's right. That's right. And I really find that a compelling idea. I don't, I haven't done the research, but it feels right to me.
It's like Lipton's research on how the membrane is where the intelligence is in a cell.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. Huh. So anyway, that's where Siri comes from, which I thought was an interesting bit of sort of historical.
So ideally, then, Siri would constantly learn from its interaction with us, as we constantly interact with Siri from many different human scenarios, and she would learn from each one, and they would feed back to the AI to improve the dynamics, ideally.
That's going on, it's going on a certain level. Siri's ability to sort of understand a variety of human speakers has really dramatically improved. So, yes, you're right. Right now, though, Siri's in design, Siri and Cortana and Google Now are all designed to be what's called productivity tools. You're not meant to have long conversations with them. You're supposed to ask them a question or tell them to do something, and they go do it for you.
How about Her? Do you think they're heading in that direction, like in the movie Her?
Okay, so that's a really good point. So Her, on the other hand, was a conversationalist, and it was sort of a companion for a lonely human being.
Yeah.
And you have to check out this experiment that Microsoft's been running in China called Zhao Ice. Zhao Ice translates as little Bing in Chinese.
Oh, 30 seconds before break, by the way.
And Zhao Ice is a chatbot, but it's a chatbot that's a little bit different than the current chatbots you've probably played with in the U.S., and that it really has got a following. There are 20 million users of Zhao Ice.
Chatbots are the following. Well, let's continue this after the break, shall we? It's fascinating. Okay. We're talking to John Markoff, who's with Machines of Loving Grace, right after the break. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with John Markoff, author of a new book, Machines of Loving Grace, about AI and robotics. And John, you were telling us about a chat box story.
Yeah, these are called chatbots. They're software programs that you can type to them. They have some ability to understand natural language, so they can understand you. You can type back. And they were the basis for what's been called the Turing test.
Yeah, to see if it's really an artificial intelligence or not.
Yes. So Microsoft, they did something a little bit different because of sort of the power of the internet. They were able to scrape virtually the entire Chinese social web, all of those websites where people have conversations. So when you type to Zhao Ice, it's very likely that they've seen your question or statement before, and they can give you a human-like answer. And so as a result of the 20 million Chinese users who are using the service, free service, 10 million are what they call, serious users, intense users. They have multiple conversations a day. They call it toilet time. They go into the bathroom late at night, and they type to this program in the cloud. And 25% have typed, I love you. 50% have typed, thank you. And so what is it significant of? Because, you're having these conversations with proxies. It kind of, to American sensibilities, it's a little bit freaky because you think of Her and sort of, us all being isolated from each other. I talked to an IBM researcher who's Chinese, and she said that it's different for the Chinese. She said, when we come to your country, it feels socially quiet. The Chinese are much more interwoven and close to each other. They have less time apart, less time by themselves. So she saw this as private time, basically the way to get a private space, be alone with your own thoughts, which was interesting.
Yeah. Huh. See, it makes me wonder if they may be interested in using the VR chat rooms that are bound to evolve over the next generation of the tech. As VR content becomes important and bandwidth is there, we'll be able to have actual communications with people as if they were in the same room, the same kind of social dynamics as we might have at a cocktail party. Only, globally. Could be an interesting way to socialize, to create events where people could meet each other, things like that. It seems to me like the Chinese-Japanese culture would lend themselves well to thinking in terms of that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And not just, I think there's lots of interesting stuff happening with VR, but also augmented reality. Augmented reality technologies are a little bit different than VR. I mean, it's sort of a way to overlay a computerized world of imagery in front of you while you see the real world at the same time.
Do you think that'll happen in the cars first, as the windshield becomes the control, you know, as you see the ads?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I think that I've seen some. I mean, it's already happening, right? There are
NVIDIA's into that, I think. NVIDIA's working with windshield manufacturer.
But you can already get BMWs and Mercedes in the market and other cars as well that have limited AR things. They'll project certain bits of information out onto the windshield. And, you know, it's sort of like jet fighters. But Google experimented with Google Glass. That didn't go really well.
Yeah.
But there are lots and lots of other experiments. Microsoft has HoloLens. And the one I'm quite intrigued with is Magic Leap, which, of course, raised all this money. And I've seen their technology. And that sort of changed my mind, actually. There's an augmentation technology. I don't know if it's true in Santa Cruz, but in San Francisco, if you walk around the streets, everybody in the street, 50% of the people are walking around the street with looking at the palm of their hand.
You're right. Right. It's very bizarre, isn't it? I mean, if you're a social anthropologist looking at the species through time, you'd really wonder.
Yeah, we used to think it was weird when people were talking to themselves on the street, like those were the crazy people. Now, everybody's the crazy people.
Oh, but ideally, if you want a screen, you just draw one where you want it, and that would be your screen.
Exactly. I mean, so my thought is that can't be the end of user interface. There has to be something next. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But when I saw the Magic Leap stuff, mm-hmm. it was interesting enough that I realized that given enough technology and enough time, that it really is quite remarkable. I mean, the resolution in the Magic Leap technology is at the limit of human diffraction. So basically, it's better than any HDTV display you've ever seen. And it's three-dimensional, and it's animated, and they can pin it in the universe. So, you know, you can have a little man walking around on the table, and it looks totally real. So I'm a believer, except...
You need to wear something, right?
Well, you do need to wear something, and I've seen their industrial designs, and they're very impressive. You know, you'd look like a hipster, but you wouldn't look totally weird.
Hmm.
But, you know, getting to that point where they can miniaturize that technology at a price point that you and I can afford. That's one of those Paul Saffo things. You know, he likes to say, never mistake a clear view for a short distance.
Yes. Yes. Might take a little longer than you think.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Well, what do you think will come first? Do you think the Oculus Rift will become popular?
So that's an interesting question. I think it's pretty cool. I haven't seen it for two generations, but I played with it. Hmm. And for me, I'm one of those people who gets sick easily in VR caves. So I worry a little bit. I mean, I love technology like that, but I worry about it.
Well, I think that's their special sauce. They're supposed to make it so that you don't get a sick from there.
Well, I'm going to be a good test for that.
Perfect. Oh, well, we couldn't ask for a better rep for that then.
I'm really intrigued. I've also played with HoloLens, and I think that's an interesting technology. Microsoft's very aggressive. But, you know, the Magic Leap guys, basically, they want to kill the entire Asian display manufacturing industry. There's no reason to have a display if you can take your fingers and draw a square anywhere in space, and that's a high-resolution display.
Yeah, it's go directly to go. You know, who needs a screen? Yeah, which would save a lot on the environment, too, while you're at it.
Yeah, exactly. But will it be here in a decade? Maybe. Yeah.
I can just see you'll have, like, a Band-Aid for your remote control on your arm or something, right? You'll just, like, slide it back and forth to control the opacity or to access the controls or something.
Exactly. I think we'll probably arrive in that. I mean, that's basically, Mark Weiser was the scientist at Xerox PARC who basically pioneered the notion of ubiquitous computing. And the idea there was that computing became pervasive and it disappeared into everyday objects and they became magic. And I believe that at some point that will happen. It just may not be as soon as we'd like.
So everything becomes more intelligent.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Well, I mean, besides like the Nest or something obvious, are there any examples that come to mind that are existing now?
Well, I give Steve Jobs great credit for this. Yeah. I think both the iPod and the iPhone were examples of the music player and the telephone becoming in computerized everyday objects becoming magic. I think lots of things will follow that sort of pattern. But the Nest is a good one, too. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Mm-hmm. How about the introduction of biosensors in clothing for feeding your AI doctor in your smartphone?
Yeah, I keep seeing stuff that's interesting. So it's clear that you're right, that things will move in that direction. I'm about to go up to University of Washington, where they're working on lots of smartphone-based sensors.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out you can do a tremendous amount with an off-the-shelf smartphone. The most interesting thing that they've done is they can pick up respiration from a sleeping human simply from the way that you and I perturb the RF field around the smartphone. They can compute the way that the RF field around the phone has changed, and they can pick up all this interesting biological information out of it, which I just love.
Let me decode. So your breath is being measured as a radio frequency?
Well, it's just you're moving because you're breathing, and that disturbs the RF field in a regular way.
Just by living, you're putting out all kinds of fields of all frequencies and types, and we're starting to be able to measure more of them.
Yeah, so there's lots of different things they can do. I don't know whether we'll get to the tricorder by the time you and I can use it. I hope so.
it looks to me like all the pieces are in place for a true renaissance in this. There just needs to be a spark to it or some way in which it all connects. Like I was just doing a story on a patch that you can put on that slightly heats underneath the skin, and where it heats up, it makes the pulsing of the blood vessels readily accessible. So we can measure our blood system, not just in terms of a measurement every so often, but an actual flowing river with measuring the contents as it flows. You know, it all becomes a real-time map very quickly. And that's fast, cheap, and out-of-control technology that's starting to happen. So I'm thinking very optimistically about us all having personal tricorders in our pockets as a natural direction. Just thinking from your perspective, where you've had a chance to talk to everybody in the industry, does that look like that could happen?
There's a brand challenge going on, and I bumped into two or three of the sort of small companies that are trying to do that. I see lots of progress. Your point, though, is that the sensors are becoming extremely cheap, and they're able to do things at this remarkable scale. So I think it's quite possible.
Excellent. Great. I have a question coming in regarding biomimicry and AI. Have you seen any evidence of those two fields converging?
Yeah. So, you know, this goes all the way back to the very dawn of artificial intelligence research. Many people point to Frank Rosenblatt, a Cornell researcher who did the first popular work in neural nets. And the neural net is biologically inspired. I don't know if that's actually the way biological neurons work, but those are our best ideas of that. And that now we have a whole set of related technologies in the field of deep learning that are having really a huge impact. Machines are starting to speak and listen, and that's because of these biologically inspired designs, neural network technologies, machine learning, where you now have the ability, because of the internet, to collect vast data samples, which is what these deep belief nets need, and they're very accurate in doing a range of different kinds of perception, first in speech and vision, and now in various kinds of robotic applications are being able to apply them there with really great results. A group at Berkeley is doing
fantastic
stuff.
We've got to go for another break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Dr. Future Show. We're talking to John Markoff. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Another question coming in, John. Are there any open source AI programs out there?
Oh, yes. I'm probably not the technical person to lay out the various options, but I can mention a couple of them.
Okay.
For machine vision, the most popular framework or platform is called OpenCV, Open Computer Vision, which is used widely for machine vision applications. And then one I know in the deep learning field that's gaining popularity is called CAFE, and it's developed by some folks, a group at Berkeley. But there are lots of tools. And then the other thing that's going on besides the open source activity, and there is a good amount of open source activity, but, you know, IBM has recently announced a commercial version of Watson. And the way they're going to make Watson available as a set of APIs of basically machine intelligence services in the cloud. They have about 23 or 24 already, and these are things that you as a programmer can use to develop applications based on everything from search to vision to natural language understanding. And IBM is out there now, but Microsoft is doing the same thing, and I believe that's the way the Google Brain will be marketed, and I'm sure that would mean that Amazon would have to jump in with similar kinds of offerings.
Yes, it heats up. Another question on biomimicry, just coming in from Greg Panos. He wonders if biomimicry and component design will leapfrog traditional methods of advancing sensor development to supply functional AI with environmental data that more closely resembles human sensory processing, like curved imaging element chips. I guess we'd start to mimic the way biological systems see more directly, perhaps.
Yeah, that is clearly, there's in the machine learning field, taking advantage of big data has had this sort of, I guess you call it an inflection point kind of impact on the world, beginning in 2012, really. Google did some work that really set off alarm bells, and that style of development is having a big impact, principally in speech and vision right now. And so the question is, how far will it go beyond perception? Not so much in progress in cognition and planning so far. The great secret at the DARPA Robotics Challenge, which was held in Los Angeles earlier this year, is that most of the machines were actually teleoperated, and they had low-level autonomous behavior, some low-level autonomous behavior, but not a lot.
Yeah, still baby steps, as they say, in that
arena. Yeah, very much baby steps.
Oh, another interesting area I'm sure you must have tracked as you investigated this thing is that a lot of the first labs were in 1962, is that what you were saying, at Stanford?
Yes, around Stanford.
Okay,
yes.
So that was about the time that the whole psychedelic thing started to happen at Stanford as well, and some creativity experiments were being done. And some, and Hassett swept the campus, and some professors would be pro and others wouldn't, and there would be explorations of technology and the consciousness movement. Anything there that you can report?
Well, you know, my previous book sort of explores this topic. It's called What the Dormouse Said, How the 60s Counterculture Shaped the Personal Computer Industry.
Yeah, fascinating book, I might add.
Thank you. And I don't draw a complete causal connection, but clearly there were different ways of exploring mind expansion, everything from the Timothy Leary approach to Doug Engelbart's approach of augmentation tools. And they were going on simultaneously. You know, my background is a social scientist, but I actually, this book was written as a journalist. I don't have causal proof that this was somehow connected to experimenting. This sort of cultural shift and interest in personal computing happened at the same time. You know, my best effort at explaining what was happening in the 60s comes from the work of some people at Santa Fe Institute who've talked about innovation in the social settings, not in societal settings, happens, they say, at the edge of chaos. And certainly what was going on around Stanford in the 60s, you know, there was a political opposition to the anti-war movement, there was this cultural renaissance happening in the form of the counterculture, and there was the microprocessor. And
all in the same place, practically.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
So their point is innovation on the edge of chaos.
Yeah, it's a soup, a sort of a consciousness soup in a way, where you need the right combination. Somehow the Bay Area has it. Mrs. Future has a question. Go ahead, Mrs. Future.
Yeah, John, I'm just wondering what your take is on the cautionary tales that are associated now with the development of artificial intelligence.
Like Terminator series?
Well, no, I mean, just like the scientists, the Stephen Hawking's, Bill Gates, Elon Musk warning about the dangers of artificial intelligence and all that.
Yeah, so starting about a year ago, there was this really fascinating discussion about self-aware machines. So I'm, along with many neuroscientists and most professionals in the AI field, I believe that any discussion of self-aware machines is really premature. There's no evidence yet that we're on the cusp of anything like that. However, let me say that I think that what they've done in raising this discussion about this possibility, and, you know, Musk put a lot of money into it. He helped fund this group called the Future of Life Foundation. And Eric Horvitz, who's a Microsoft AI researcher, has created a separate foundation at Stanford, all sort of concerned about the issues of progress in this technology. And, you know, I think it's important work. It's an important question they've raised, because even if the machines aren't self-aware, it's clear that increasingly machines are going to be autonomous. So decision-making is dedicated to AI systems, and there are real ethical questions that are raised about separating decision-making from control. So even though the machines may not be crawling out of the test tube anytime soon, I still think it's important to talk about these things.
Yeah, that's a very interesting dichotomy, decision-making versus control, because I think that the control part of it is what the boogeyman is all about. People don't want to be controlled by these machines that are intended to be superior to our monkey bodies or our human brains or whatever. But the decision-making part of it, it seems that we want all the benefits of having more information at the fingertips of the decision-making beings, whether those are augmented humans, whether those are robots using artificial intelligence. All of those things are about humans being improved by the environment being more attuned to what they're doing, right?
I think you're right. It's very clear in the case of an autonomous weapon. You're basically giving life and death decision-making to a machine, but it's more subtle in something like a self-driving car, where cars are going to have to make ethical decisions. And it's not clear that we've thought out exactly. You know, there's a lot of responsibility transferred from the software designer to the software program. I was using control in the sense of human control. If you build machines that operate outside of human control, it raises really important ethical questions, I think, and not just in warfare. In everywhere that these machines are going to operate in the unstructured world, they're going to be forced to make decisions, and we should think about it, and we should try to develop rules and sort of ethical codes about how these machines operate in the world.
Well, yeah, when you use the word control, I get a very fuzzy line in terms of where does the control actually begin and end?
Don't you think we'll have more pragmatic uses initially, like intelligent elder care robots for the baby boomers?
Well, that's a really wonderful point. I sort of came over to believe that, first of all, it's super important because the world's population is aging dramatically quickly. Very quickly, more quickly than people realize, and it's really going to transform society. And the way to look at it is, will the robots come in time?
Yes, in my backyard, yes.
So the way I'd like to frame this is, when will a machine be able to safely give a human a shower? And right now, we're nowhere near that capability.
Wow, that's profound. So what are the machines best at in elder care now?
It would be very helpful if there were machines that would help aging humans maintain their balance. It would be great if cars were turned into elder care robots so that they could allow people to be independent and drive longer safely.
So for the handicapped to have autonomous vehicles first would make
mobility.
Sense. It's like boarding first on the airplane.
Yeah, like a little guardian angel over their shoulder to save them from doing things stupid. So that's all technology that's kind of close but not there yet. There are people designing machines to give people their pills at the right time and make sure they've taken them. Very simple things like that. There is this discussion of whether you could have a companion that would be helpful, basically an autonomous conversationalist. That's a very sort of controversial point. One thing that a lot of work is going on around is sensor networks inside the home that could keep track of elders and alert people when there's a problem. And that would allow people to age in place longer. And I think that's probably one of the near-term technologies.
Now, is your book out now? Is this something people can access?
Yeah, it's called Machines of Love and Grace, The Search for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots, and it's published by HarperCollins, and you can get it at lots of independent bookstores and hard copy, too.
Excellent. And Kindle versions and that.
Yeah.
Now, in your final minute, what would you like to see happen with this? What kind of machine of love and grace would you most like to experience while you're still alive?
That's interesting that you asked that question. I guess simply, I still feel like the promise of personal computing is unfulfilled. I'd like to see, as a reporter and a writer, I want to see better augmentation tools, things to help me as a writer. I'm still working with a text processor. How many years later?
Yes.
You know, we should have better tools. That's what I would
better think. Tools to communicate.
Yes.
All right, tell stories. Excellent. Thank you, John, for being on our show.
Sure, I appreciate it. Thanks for having
bet.
Me, guys.
You bet. Have a good afternoon.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. That was John Markoff, science correspondent for the New York Times and author of book Machines of Loving Grace, all about artificial intelligence and robotics. Thanks.
KSEO Santa Cruz.